I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And I think it's not enough to kind of just have a general sense, oh yeah, my mind is reactive, how can I chill out? Which, that's a good first step. So this is where mindfulness is so important. We can really pinpoint, you know, what it is that's happening on a moment-to-moment level in our minds and in our hearts.
Hey everyone, it's Mind Rolling. I'm back with a favorite person of mine from way back and of Ram Dass's and a new favorite person, not that new anymore, my son Noah Marcus, who is basically a devotee of Joseph at this point, because every time I say I'm going to do something with Joseph, okay, I'd love to come along on that ride. But I'm gonna. First of all, we haven't seen you in a while, and I know you're just back from California, and ensconced in the woods of Barry.
Right, in the quite warm woods of Barry these days.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, not unlike many other places these days.
Yeah, it's quite something what's going on, adding to the experience of being overwrought that many people, most of us in one way or the other, are certainly dealing with. So I just wanted to, because we haven't talked in a while, and just thinking about really the current state of affairs, which is really tough, from the environmental issues that we are directly experiencing these days to the vast divide in this country, the polarization. And that's something that, I want to talk about and get your feedback a little bit. Just there's such vast uncaring on both sides of whatever the issue is. And then I started to think, I interviewed Joseph, or chatted with a monk from the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. And he said, I spent 20 years being the perfect meditator, perfect mindfulness, perfect acolyte of Thich Nhat Hanh, of Thay. But there was that divide inside myself never disappeared, no matter how hard I tried. And he he said, so at one point, I guess he fell in love with, I don't know if it was a nun or something, but he fell in love and he got married. He said, after that, after he kind of let go of this holding on to make something happen, then that divide fell away and things unified within himself. And he was basically talking about, we are all polarized inside ourselves between that I that we relate to on a moment-to-moment basis and true nature, whatever you want to call that. Ram Dass would call it soul. We have that great thing, by the way, Joseph, of you and Ram Dass talking about emptiness and love. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. It's going to be actually part of this wonderful retreat. For the first time in the East Coast that we're doing a retreat actually in the hills of North Carolina.
Oh, great.
And that's going to be one of the segments that we're going to talk about. It's about the intersection of bhakti and Buddhism, which we spent a lot of time on when you and all the friends would come over.
Not many people equate emptiness and love, so it's.
I think it's
an interesting opening.
Exactly. But just in terms of that inner, the way that we are divided and separated inside ourselves has to be a. It has to reflect on how we see and how we relate with the outside world. No.
Yeah, but that's starting off, I think, in a. Very high place of understanding, you know, like the understanding that we're all one, right? And I think it's more useful to really look at the nitty-gritty of how the divide gets strengthened within us. In other words, to see the dynamics of how it's working within ourselves rather than as a kind of abstraction. Of unity, because we could all agree that that's a good idea.
Yeah.
But then, what to do? You know, how to accomplish it? And for me, it comes down to something pretty simple, at least as a starting point. And that is, and I see it in myself, which is, you know, we're all our own best laboratory for understanding what's going on. So when I look at my own mind, when I see myself polarized, I really see it has to do with the level of reactivity in my mind. You know, I see things going on that I don't like and I don't agree with and I think are harmful. And then I can get really upset in a reactive way. And that just furthers the divide, you know, us and them and good and bad. So I think the first step is looking at, in a very specific way, really, really becoming mindful and looking at how the reactivity is manifesting very specifically. You know, is it in the thoughts we have? Is it in the emotions that we're feeling? So that we become mindful of that pattern, which is pretty common, I think, in many of us, you know, the reactive mind. And then it's beginning to explore, and there are really ways to do this, to explore how we can let go of the reactivity so that we can come to a place of, I don't know, you might call it wise responsiveness. Coming from a balanced place, coming from an equanimous place rather than a reactive place. And right here is it's how we can develop more equanimity in the face of everything. And then the next step, I think, is being aware of the danger of equanimity or a facsimile of equanimity leading to resignation. You know, because we might come to, okay, we've dealt with our own reactivity into some kind of a space that may look like equanimity, but it's not really. Yeah, and we become just resigned and apathetic or, you know, something in that range. So here is where I found this really interesting. To see that precisely here is where compassion comes in. If we can let go of our reactivity and then really open to the situation that's there, with the question, and we've talked about this before, I think, and it's, you know, it's the title of one of the books that Ram Dass and Paul Gorman wrote, How Can I Help?
Yeah.
I love that phrase, because it just makes very immediate the question and the possibility of a whole range of responses that are coming from compassion rather than us just venting through our reactive mind, which really doesn't help, and it just furthers the divisiveness. And underneath all of this, mindfulness is the key. Mm. You know, if we're not mindful, we're not aware of our reactivity, we don't really know how to come to equanimity. And mindfulness also plays a really key role in the development of compassion.
Mm. You know, you just talked about many of us do get into a place where through practice and mindfulness, we have tremendous awareness of our motivation factors in terms of every phenomena that is approaching or that we are interacting with, and that we is that thing of fooling ourselves, that we create a mirage about how we have overcome that reactive nature. You just mentioned that a little bit before. Can you, maybe some examples of that would be great.
Well, I'm not sure what you meant in terms of...
That when you said before that when you seem to have a handle on reactivity to phenomenon, but you're fooling yourself. You are not completely in a place where that equanimity is not solid. Maybe that's it.
Well, there are a couple of things. One is, and this is kind of diving a little deeper into kind of how our minds work. Mm. When we find ourselves at first being quite reactive to the major issues that are going on, which are a lot, you know, it's not hard to understand why people might be feeling overwhelmed by it all, because there's a lot that's overwhelming. So we might become aware of that reactivity in a general sense, right? And maybe that gives us a little bit of space in our minds. But I think to really come to a place of real clarity with it all, the reactivity is happening because we are identifying with certain thought patterns or certain emotional patterns, right? And it's the identification with those that is the reactivity. So those thoughts and emotions are going to arise, you know, unless we're a saint, given all the turmoil in the world. They are going to arise. So then the question is, how are we relating to them? And I think it's not enough to kind of just have a general sense, oh yeah, my mind is reactive, how can I chill out? Which, that's a good first step. But then to really look quite specifically, okay, what particular thought is arising in the mind that I'm getting caught by? You know, and it might be a thought of blame or condemnation or frustration or whatever it might be, but it's something specific. It's not simply an abstract sense of overwhelm, right? The overwhelm is happening because we're getting lost in or identified with that particular thought or that particular emotion.
Right.
So this is where mindfulness is so important. We can really pinpoint, you know, what it is that's happening on a moment-to-moment level in our minds and in our hearts. Really, if we can do that, that mindfulness itself, I think, helps to stabilize the equanimity. Because we're really dealing with it. We're dealing with the causes of the reactivity rather than the simple perception, oh yeah, my mind is really reactive. You know, we're drilling down a little deeper and seeing the specifics of it. And then there are ways of furthering the stabilizing ability, the ability to stabilize the equanimity. So it's not just kind of a momentary dropping into a place of relative balance, but a place where we can actually abide, you know, for longer periods of time.
Yeah. And also, I think it's probably good to point out to everybody that it's not all or nothing. You know, you don't just in a moment stop completely reacting. You know, it may, as you said, it may be relative, you know, within that moment, but just the awareness, as Ram Dass called it, just witnessing it, is very, very helpful, even though it's maybe not that stabilized.
Right.
And even though you still may be chasing it, chasing the emotion or the thought, but just even a, given a moment of awareness and mindfulness is a big step.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be, oh shit, you know, 3 minutes later, I was just doing the same damn thing as if I never learned that lesson.
Right. I would add something to, I think it needs something more than awareness/mindfulness. I think that's necessary, but not sufficient. Yeah. Because I think that we need to develop an understanding that comes from being aware. And that's really what I was talking about earlier. That, yeah, we want to be aware of it, but then understand what's the mechanism by which it's arising in the mind. You know, the reactivity. And that's what I was talking before about, just really seeing the identification with very particular thoughts and very particular emotions. So the understanding piece of how reactivity comes about, I think, is the key to working with it in a more sustained way.
Mm. Yeah.
And I want to just reiterate what you said. No matter how much we understand, it's not going to be a momentary, okay, reactivity all gone. It's definitely an ongoing process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Many lifetimes, really.
Well, hopefully not too many.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, I turn it over to you.
I have something connected to that. You started to talk about apathy there for a second. Mm. And I want to know about dealing with a sense of hopelessness around all of this, around our political stuff and around climate change, these big picture things where it's just like, yeah, it's overwhelming. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
And it gets to a point where it's so overwhelming, you shut down around it, right?
Yeah.
And it's easier just to say, yeah, okay, we're all going to, you know, most people are going to be dead soon enough from climate change. There'll be a few of us, maybe we'll be lucky to survive. Who knows? But we're going that way. So
right.
Down goes the ship. I'm going to go watch another sunset. How do we deal with
that? Well, I think that's, you know, what I just mentioned briefly before, that question, which can be the expression of compassion. How can I help? But I think the important thing there is, I'm going to use this term quite loosely, but it's almost like a koan, you know. So it's not necessarily having some grand idea about it all, but almost trusting one's heart and intuition. If we hold that question and realize that it may be in really small things, small and local. You know, how can I help just in my little world? Or it might be some people are really visionary, you know, and maybe they do, you know, come up with a way of helping that's on a much larger scale. But we shouldn't, it may be that some people get discouraged if they're not visionary, you know, and because of that, then they feel helpless or hopeless. But I found that when I really ask myself that question, there's a whole range of scale, you know, in which a response might come in. It might be something really small and local, like, I don't know, supporting a local food bank. You know, that's just one little example of many things that we can do in our own little world. And so I'll just, a little sidebar here. So there is a formal compassion meditation, right? Just like there is metta, the loving kindness, there's a way of focusing on compassion. And it's pretty interesting. The way one starts with the compassion meditation is to think of somebody in an extreme example of suffering. So that's where we start, because that's an easy situation to evoke compassion. No. And then it's just the repetition. So we hold that image in our minds, and it's the simple repetition of the phrase, "May you be free of suffering." That's it, just one phrase. So it becomes like a mantra of compassion. You know, may you be free of suffering, holding the vivid image of it. Now, what I found so interesting about doing this practice is that here we are. I was holding this image of a lot of suffering, repeating that phrase. And even though the whole field was a field of suffering, with my intention, may you be free of it, it was very uplifting. So one might think, oh, if I start really coming close to the suffering that's out there, it's going to be further overwhelming. Right? But actually coming close to it with that intention, you know, may you be free of suffering, or how can I help, or whatever phrase really resonates within oneself. Even though we're coming close to the suffering, and in fact that's needed, it's uplifting when our inner space is coming from that place of compassionate care. So it really transforms the feeling of overwhelm to the feeling of, one might say, confidence or uplift, because we are responding in a, in a truthful way to the situation, you know. And this is really where mindfulness comes in, because, you know, as we all know, sometimes it's not easy to come close to suffering or to open to it, and we have a lot of inner defenses, you know, of just, I don't want to deal with it, or push it away, or just, you know, let me go to the movies or something to distract ourselves. And so we need a discipline, really, which trains us that it's okay to feel the unpleasantness. It's okay to feel the suffering, because there's a lot of conditioned tendency, which is we only want what's pleasant and we don't want to experience anything unpleasant. And this is what most people think. And you can understand why, but it's the natural state of things. You know, of course I want what's pleasant and don't want what's unpleasant. But that closes us off to a compassionate response. Mm. Because compassion arises from the willingness to come close to the suffering. Mm. And that's why the mindfulness meditation is a training in this, because, you know, as you and the listeners know, you know, in meditation, it's like there's some discomfort or pain in the body. It's okay to feel it. You know, so we're training ourselves, yeah, this is okay. I can come close to this. Mm. And then we can apply that to, you know, the suffering in the world. So this is why it's so interesting to me how mindfulness, equanimity, and compassion, kind of it's a trio of qualities in the mind that can really help us address what's going on these days. Yeah. And it's not easy. So I don't want to suggest that, okay, we hear all this and it's a practice, you know, and it takes
like
practice.
Like anything, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I come too close to some forms of suffering, my heart just shuts down.
Yeah.
It, you know, there's a dead spot in there where I force all those things that I don't want to feel and don't want to deal with. And that's it, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't.
So what I would suggest is, well, the way to get there is in small steps. So you don't necessarily want to walk into fire, you know, but you can come close to the fire and begin to feel the heat of it, you know, and really watch for that point where it becomes too much for that time. Okay, I see the mind beginning to close down. Okay, so we might want to take a little time coaching ourselves a bit. Okay, can I relax? Can I open? Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, it is too much. You know, and we have to pull back. We have to create a little rest for the mind. You know, and then at another time, again, we come close as we can. And so I think there is a way to do it gradually, not necessarily diving into the heart of it all.
Back to all or nothing new.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's our mindset, right?
Yeah.
Well, we got to be winners here in the West. It's winning and proving.
That also just ties into, in a way, demonizing others, you know, who particularly
easier
if we really think that they're doing something really harmful or whatever. And another line that has been really helpful for me when I find myself getting reactive, and it could be just in a very individual interpersonal interaction, or it could be something, you know, more global. But what I found really useful is when I ask myself the question, well, why do these other people think the way they do? Instead of jumping to condemnation or judgment, again, it comes to an understanding. Well, they have this viewpoint. They have this perspective. Why? What? And just that begins to break down the us and them, right? Even though it doesn't mean we agree with their perspective, but at least there's some understanding, oh, this is why they may be feeling the way they do or acting the way they do. And that again opens up at least the possibility of some communication. You know, if there's just judgment and reactivity and condemnation, that's not going anyplace.
Yeah, as we are seeing so glowing cinematheque color right now. Oh boy.
Connected to that and to all the polarization stuff, I wanted to ask you about, this is something I heard you talk about a little bit in one of the talks I was taking notes on, right listening. Can you talk about right listening in terms of polarization?
Yeah.
A little bit.
So I'm glad you asked that because this is one of my favorites.
Oh, really?
It's a teaching of the Buddha, but it sets a very high bar, which we will probably not reach, but at least it points to a direction. So he was giving this one discourse, and he said, people may address you or talk to you in one of five ways. And I'm not sure I have all remember all five, but it's basically this. They may speak what's true or what's not true. They may speak gently or harshly. They may speak with an intent to harm or an intent to benefit. They may speak with a heart of inner hate or a heart of kindness. So he goes down this list of just the different ways people may communicate with us. But then he says, regardless of how people are speaking to you, you should abide with a heart of loving kindness, concern for their welfare, and then goes on and on like that. And so I just try to imagine myself in that situation, you know, where somebody's lying to me, wanting to harm me, you know, and speaking angrily and harshly. Oh, abide with a mind, a heart of loving kindness, concern for their welfare. It's not easy. But even just having that as a reference point for a direction, and again, it points to, okay, when people are speaking to us, can we be mindful? Can we be listening with mindfulness so that we're registered? We're not pretending that they're saying the truth. We're not pretending that they're not angry or wanting to harm. We're seeing it clearly, but we're not reactive to it, right? And in fact, there is the possibility, you know, when our minds are in a place of relative calm, I think really at that time, it is possible to start feeling compassion, you know, because in those situations, if we're not buying into our own reaction, it's not hard to see the suffering that people are in. You know, why do people communicate in really harmful ways? You know, part of this is also, it's not only mindful listening. I've learned this a lot on retreats and meeting with people, you know, in all kinds of states. And it's not only listening, but it's also seeing mindfully. Because just, as I just said, sometimes when people are, you know, speaking or acting in a really unskillful way, when I look at them, I'm just looking mindfully. As I said, the suffering becomes so obvious. It's not even hidden. You can just see it. You can see it in their bodies, in their faces. And it's what I found, and it was really quite remarkable, because in situations where I might have been reactive with that person, as soon as I could see the suffering, it was amazing. In the moment, it transformed into compassion. It was not something I even had to think about. It was just by seeing the suffering instead of reacting to whatever they were saying or how they were saying it. So there's some great possibilities for real transformation in these challenging interactions.
And isn't, you know,
the Dalai Lama had this great line. I think it comes from Shantideva, actually. You know, you should honor your enemies. They teach you patience.
Yeah.
It's really easy to be patient and loving, you know, when people are loving
yeah,
back.
Yeah.
The test is when it's challenging.
I just wanted to, just going on that line of the power of listening, even one step further. I think it was Simone Weil, the French writer, mm-hmm. who said, the most generous act mm-hmm. that you can perform with another human being is giving them your total attention. That just reminded me of that. Yeah. And then you quoted His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. Well, it's not a quote. It's actually when you said, when you meet the Dalai Lama, it feels like you are one of the most important person in the world in that moment, because the quality of his attention on you in that moment is so complete. And not to compare Ram Dass with His Holiness, Ram Dass certainly had some attributes that were pretty amazing. And I used to say, many's a time I have said, either in podcasts or at retreats, when I first met Ram Dass, he was able to set aside Richard Alpert and Ram Dass, and just I was the center of the universe, that he had that gift. You know, and it wasn't like it was moment to moment for his life, although after his stroke and when he was in Maui, it certainly manifested in a larger way. But yeah, that was, I mean, that's what got me to India, basically, was that ability that he, there was such trust, intuitive trust that, that happened. And that happens with everyone. If you, you even give it a shot where you stop thinking, but how can I, well, I got 2 minutes now, I can talk to this person, you know. And once you let go of all that stuff, the way in which someone starts to feel way more comfortable is visceral, really.
And again, I mean, in that kind of situation that you described, which is very powerful, and I think that's one of the great powers that people like His Holiness has, you know, and why he's transformative for so many people. To really see again where mindfulness comes in, because most of us are not quite at the level that His Holiness is at yet.
Wild understatement,
So we, our attention to another person might not be total, but if we're mindful of our own inner process, we can watch when our mind starts. Just people are talking and then our mind starts interjecting or thinking about what it's going to say in response getting ahead of ourselves. If we're not mindful of what's going on in our minds, we're not going to see that and then drop back again to listening. So I think mindfulness is really the key to cultivating these very qualities.
And I think you wrote a pretty good book called Mindfulness. So everybody out there, if you haven't heard me say it, it's, you know, maybe I'm going on to the 200th time, get Joseph's book. It's called Mindfulness, and it is absolutely complete in terms of understandable. I mean, that's not the right word, but
comprehensible.
Yeah, comprehensible. I'll take that. I'll buy that. And also, I don't know if you remember when you came to teach in Maui once, you were going to go do a solo session, you know, teaching session. And you said to me, what should I talk about? I said, what do you mean? Mindfulness. You go, mindfulness? That's like 3 weeks, not 75 minutes. I said, well, maybe boil it down. And you did. I give that out, Joseph, I swear, to people who are looking for some way to get a little bit more understanding. And what you just said is so clear about seeing the motivations while you are emptying. That process to me is the most important thing. Again, it's not all or nothing. It's happening, exactly. And you have the intention, and you see, you know, where your shortfall is.
You know, just a kind of further little hint with you know, a way of helping us do that. When if we notice that our mind is just getting ahead of ourselves, you know, and we're not in that really deep listening mode, just in that very moment and seeing that, I think coming back to mindfulness of the body, just being aware of ourselves sitting there, that brings us back, you know, and it's not complicated and it's, you don't have to be, you know, some fantastic meditator to do that. Yeah. It's just the body's so apparent, but it's getting into the habit, you know, and the Buddha, he emphasized so much mindfulness of the body.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and yeah, it's just something we can practice throughout the day. It doesn't require any special time. You know, whatever we're doing, the body's there, obviously. Mm. And it's not some necessarily subtle object that we have to have super samadhi to become aware of. So establishing that habit in my life has been hugely helpful.
People talk about, well, it's very hard for me to go and sit for a few minutes every day. I can't seem to get into a regular program and so on. And I usually say to them, well, you have a lot of habitual patterns. Just make this one of them so you never have to think about it. You just go sit, you know, replace the...
So there's one other little suggestion for people who are finding a hard time establishing a regular practice. So this is something that absolutely anybody can do. Anybody. And that is making the commitment to at least get into the meditative posture once a day. Doesn't matter how long. You get into the posture, you get up. You fulfilled your commitment. So anybody can do that. But what one finds is that once one is in the posture, it's not that hard to sit for however long. Maybe it'll be 5 minutes. Maybe it'll be half an hour or an hour, whatever. That the hard part is the disengaging from our busyness. That's the piece that's hard. It's not hard to sit once you're in the posture, you know. But instead of burdening oneself with, oh, I have to sit this length of time, and if I can't sit that, then it's not worth doing. This is the absolute minimum. Just get into the posture.
That's great.
But I've gotten a lot of feedback that often that's enough.
Really?
To begin establishing the regularity, you know, of a practice.
That's cool. I love that. I love that. Noah, do you got another one for us?
Yeah, we have time for...
Oh, yeah.
I was looking today, the last time the three of us had our little chat was just early February 2020, right before things.
We didn't do anything in 21? We do once a year.
No.
Oh, no, God. It's been a while.
Oh, it's been a while. Yeah,
I thought so you forgot all about me, Robin.
Oh, God. No, I never.
Joseph, I just want to know what was your experience of COVID times like? And I don't know if there was any particular practice that you relied on to get through such a turbulent time.
You know, in a way, I feel very fortunate living in Barrie, you know, which is where IMS, the center, is. It's a very small town. The center itself is out of town, and the town itself is tiny. So it was just really easy to, I could be walking outside, walking in the woods. I had a little small bubble, you know, of a few friends. And so within that bubble, we would get together. And being who I am, I love being alone. So that was not a hardship for me. Other people, you know, might have felt that aspect more troublesome. But for me, it was like, oh, this is nice. the challenging part was, for me, feeling quite really at ease, and at the same time knowing what was going on all around. You know, and that was interesting to, okay, how do I hold all of this? Because it wasn't affecting me so much personally, but I was very aware, of the devastating impact for so many people. So that was the that was the dance that I was going through.
I felt a similar way. I worked from home before the pandemic started, and I didn't want to go out and be that social anyway. So it was this is okay for me, but I understand it's such horrible suffering going on all around me.
Maybe it'll boost the volunteers for introverts.
I have one thing that I think we still have time for. We can try see if you can after this we can get you to lead us in a little meditation. But you talked about something called, and this fits in with everything that we've been discussing around mindfulness and its enormous transformative capability. You called it the shadow of concepts. I don't know if you remember that. It's from a talk. It may be from some time back. It's on Be Here Now Network. Joseph, by the way, everybody, has a wonderful podcast. We take talks of his and over decades. I saw one that was from when you did the thing with Ram Dass in 74 in Naropa. It's amazing. Wow.
Just to say that it's not my podcast, it's your podcast, which I'm very grateful for the whole the Be Here Now Network putting it on, because left to my own devices, it wouldn't be around. So
you'll be walking in the woods. Thank you. Yes. So the idea that the world of mental constructs that we create on a moment-to-moment basis, and the attachment we have to those concepts, as if it's God speaking the word to us, is so strong that we take it to be reality and do not question it. And to me, that gets us into an awful lot of problems. That belief system, it's like belief in thoughts. We all understand that and the corrosiveness of that. I love this term, the shadow of concepts, because of our gigantic belief. Can you extrapolate that a little bit?
So this is a hugely important point in the whole understanding of meditation and insight and really awakening. So I'm trying to think that what's the best way into this, because this is a huge topic. So I'll just give a few examples, and then I think it won't be difficult to extrapolate that to many other things. But the first one is just something that my teacher Munindraji said very often. It's a line that is both so obvious but so undervalued, or not even seen. He would say, "The thought of your mother is not your mother. It's a thought." And you could substitute anything for mother. The thought of it is not the thing itself. It's just a thought. So that's kind of in the most general way, how we create all kinds of thoughts and concepts about things, which I'm not suggesting that they are never useful. Because obviously we use our thought process. We need to use concepts to navigate the world. The important point is that we see them for what they are rather than taking them to be the reality.
Absolute
itself.
Reality, yeah.
So I'll give another example, and this is just an example that can come from a very simple meditative exercise, but it also points to why this distinction is so important. Mm. So in walking meditation, you know, which is a big part of the practice, we're just walking and the instruction is to be mindful, to be aware, you know, of the movement of the foot or the leg and, you know, touching the ground. So the shadow of concept, and this is quite common, especially toward the beginning of one's practice, but even for people quite experienced. So we can be walking and feeling the leg moving, and even being aware of the sensations of the movement, but still, very often there is a subtle overlay of a sense of or image of the leg and the foot. Right? So even as we're walking, we're experiencing the sensations through the filter of that image or concept of foot or leg, you know, and that's either very strong and solid, or it might be quite, is the word diaphanous, you know, very not so solid, but still there. Now, why is this important? You know, so what? The problem with not seeing the difference between the concepts, the shadow of concept, and the direct experience is that the concept doesn't change. Leg, I have a leg today, I have a leg tomorrow, I had a leg yesterday. If we're seeing that experience through the filter of a leg or a foot, even as we're walking, we're not fully seeing the changing, momentary, impermanent nature of the experience. Mm. There's no sensation called leg. So we're not feeling a leg. We're not feeling foot, right? We're feeling, you know, pressure or vibration or heaviness or lightness. These are the sensations that are being felt. As I say, there's no sensation called leg or foot. That's the shadow of the concept which we're overlaying on top of the flow of changing sensations. Mm. To the degree that we don't see that, we are reinforcing to some degree some level of permanence, because the concept, the word, doesn't change. And not only that, and this goes an even more subtle point, when we're in the world of concept and leg, for example, of foot, it's an easy next step to my leg, my foot. And so we're reinforcing this whole sense of self, of I, whereas we would not be saying my pressure, my lightness. You know, when we're on the level of what's actually happening, the understanding of what is for many people the most difficult aspect of the teachings of selflessness, when we're on that level of direct experience without that shadow of concept, then the selfless nature of it all becomes much more apparent. Mm. Right. So it has very profound implications, and this is a very simple example just from walking and foot and leg, but as you suggested, you know, so many of our opinions and thoughts and, you know, we just solidify them into thinking that that is the reality rather than seeing that's just a thought in our minds. And it may be accurate, it may be inaccurate, but it's not the thing itself.
Yeah.
So this is really a key point in the whole unfolding of the meditative process.
Yeah. Our friend Bob Thurman at one point was talking about the power of ignorance, right? The Maya.
Yeah.
And he said, but there's one other thing that makes that seem like BS, and that is where you actually think you know something. You actually believe in a something as a permanent resident, so to speak. You know.
Well, that's why I don't know that you remember. I know you ever met Sansanim, you know, the founder of the Providence Zen Center and Korean Zen master. And he had, I would say his English was not fluent, you know, so, but very expressive. And he had a whole teaching which he called Don't Know Mind. You know,
don't know mind.
Yeah. So it points to what you were saying.
Right. Bernie Glassman as well, right?
Yeah.
Don't Know Mind was part of, especially in the last years. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, you know, that famous line from Suzuki Roshi from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Something like, in the expert's mind, there are few possibilities. In the beginner's mind, there are many. It's a paraphrase, but that was the basic point.
Yeah, it's wide open. So,
one last little phrase. Another one of my favorites, by just talking about attachment to our own viewpoint. This is from Bankai, who was, I think, a 16th century Japanese Zen master. Very iconoclastic, not a traditional one. He had one line. He said, "Don't side with yourself."
That's the best.
That would be such a good reminder as we're getting caught up in whatever conflicts we do.
That's terrific. That's terrific. I love that.
I want to run for president and use that as my slogan.
Really. So, Joseph, we're at the end of our time, but can you lead us in a meditation?
Sure.
A few minutes would be great. And you talked about, by the way, here's a plug, a shameless plug. We have a Ram Dass Be Here Now new app, which it's in testing phase, that Noah's a big part of. And he created what's called a micro dose from Ram Dass and others like yourself, where he you know, great sound bites. So you program it so that 3 times a day you get one of these micro doses to stop you in your tracks during the day. So you mentioned, you know, I think you talked about it, doing the embody meditation at certain points. So if you feel it, that'd be great.
So take a comfortable but alert posture, however that may be. Generally, in our tradition, we sit with our eyes closed, but it doesn't really matter. One can also sit with the eyes just slightly open if that's what you're accustomed to. And begin by simply taking a few deep breaths as a way of settling into the body. And don't be afraid to really breathe deeply. 2 or 3 times. Then simply settle into the awareness of the body, letting the breath find its own natural rhythm. Remembering that this is not a breathing exercise, it's an exercise in awareness. Just sit and know you're sitting. Feeling the body posture. A phrase that many people have found helpful is, there is a body. Just intermittently, you might repeat that phrase in the mind, there is a body. And it's simply a reminder to settle into the awareness of the whole body sitting. And within the framework, the larger framework that is a body, you may become aware of the sensations of the body breathing. There's no need to narrow the attention necessarily on the feeling of the breath, although one can do that. But often people find it more easeful to keep the larger context of the whole body sitting and simply be aware of the sensations of the body breathing within that larger framework. There is a body. Become aware of the sensations of the body breathing. And you can also feel any other sensations that may appear and call your attention. And as you feel the different sensations in the body, notice what happens to them as you become aware. Notice whether they are changing in some way. And stay alert for the appearance of any thoughts or images in the mind. Simply becoming aware that the mind is thinking, or if it's an image, seeing. And notice what happens to the thought as you become aware of it. There is a body. Aware of the sensations of the body breathing. Mindful of other sensations that call your attention, noticing their changing nature.
and staying alert for the appearance of any thoughts or images that arise in the mind. Sometimes a soft mental note of thinking or seeing helps to strengthen the mindfulness of them. You can also settle back into a very spacious awareness, becoming mindful of any sounds that may be arising. Staying grounded in the awareness of the body and aware of any aspect of experience that becomes predominant, calls our attention. And we can suffuse the whole field of mindfulness with the feeling of loving kindness. Friendliness towards our own experience and well-wishing for all others. May all beings be at peace. Before we end, I'd like to share a little haiku poem, which arose in my mind when I was on retreat. But I think it could be a basic instruction for all meditation practice. Bird song in the empty sky of my mind. And I think if one could keep that image and experience this, I mean, it's a common experience of bird song or any sounds in the empty sky of my mind. You know, and so can we have everything be a bird song in that empty sky of awareness?
As we would say, Ram Ram.
Yes. <It's>
Hindu. Yeah, that's beautiful, Joseph. Really beautiful. I thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Yeah. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Really, yeah. Really. So everyone, of course, you can listen to Joseph's podcast. Go to Be Here Now Network, Insight Hour, it is called. And then one thing I happened to notice today somehow was the wonderful course that Joseph and Sharon Salzberg put together around the practice of Vipassana, insight meditation through Sounds True, actually. I think if you go to Sounds True, you'll easily find it, because many people say, well, where do I go? When, because I'm always suggesting that this particular practice for me has been fundamental for all of the years that I met Joseph in Bodh Gaya. I won't say when, but a long time ago, where he introduced me to his teacher, Munindraji. And so, yes, we'll put a link up, actually. We'll do better than just saying go to Sounds True. We'll put a link up, because this is something that can really help with foundationally. This is a practice. You take advantage of it. That's all I can say. Okay. And Joseph's book, Mindfulness, will be there too. So again, thank you so much. And thank you, Noah, for joining us.
Yeah.
And this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and just experience the wonderful variety of different Dharma teachers, thought leaders, and so on. So we shall see you next week.